This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And I'm especially happy because our guest today is going to be Dr. Tanya Bilczyk. Dr. Bilczyk has been on our show multiple times. We try to get her on at least once a year to discuss headache. She is a specialist in headache, and there are so many changes in the field of headache and the treatment of headache, especially migraine types of headaches. But, you know, we're always hearing about the use of Botox and some surface devices, things like that, that may help with headache. So we're going to be chatting with Dr. Bilczyk a little bit later on. The CDC reported this week that there have been 216 child deaths from influenza this season. So the season overlaps between 2024 and 2025. This is the greatest number of deaths in children from influenza in the past 15 years. So clearly, we're moving in the wrong direction when it comes to this. When we're discussing and looking at influenza and the use of vaccines. Obviously, what has happened is people are refraining from vaccinating their children, even against the flu. So from that standpoint, we're starting to see this rise. And there was a rise last year as well. I have a feeling we're going to see it again. And this does end in death for many children. This day in medicine, May 3rd, 1765, doctors John Morgan and William Shippen, Jr., established the first medical department in the College of Philadelphia. And this is really the first medical school in the American colonies back in 1765. So we remember that today and the anniversary of really starting that whole system of medical education in the United States. Interesting also that, I mean, obviously we've had medical schools for centuries in Europe and carrying over that type of education and the system of education and developing one here that has become fairly unique. Today I really want to talk about the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. And the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, is part of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. And I want to direct you, if you have a chance, to go back and look at, there was a 60 Minutes presentation last Sunday, so that's April 27th, really looking at NIH and where they are today. But I thought it would be worthwhile for us to kind of revisit and look at NIH and where it came from. You know, a lot of people only came to know it during COVID because it was the premier agency worldwide going out and looking at a treatment, a vaccine, things like that. But my first encounter with NIH was actually when I was a resident at the University of Michigan, when I began to realize how many scientists in our Department of Neurology were funded by NIH. And this funding was kind of like the gold ribbon of your research. It is so rigorous to get an NIH grant, maintain an NIH grant, because of the rigor. And I can't think of a better word for it. It just demands so much good science and knowledge and management of those funds. But really, the NIH came about back in 1887, And really, it was a lab in the Marine Hospital Service, which was the forerunner of the U.S. Public Health Service. The Marine Health Service was, and I thought, right, was it for Marines? But it was actually founded in 1798 to provide medical care for seamen and inspect passengers as they came to this country to make sure they were not suffering from cholera or yellow fever. And it developed into a research foundation and a research organization. The NIH is the primary agency responsible for biomedical and public health research in this country, and it is recognized as the premier organization in the world. 80% of the funds, actually, are distributed to other universities through a very rigorous process. It has a $47 billion budget. So it is huge. And obviously, the question becomes, what are we getting for the money? And it's interesting that the studies have shown that for every dollar that gets put into a research project from NIH, we're able to reap $2.46 within 1 year. And that's because of the advances they make. When we think about those advances in tests and therapeutics, we really have to look at what have we gotten for it. So let's look at a snapshot of the last 40 years. In the last 40 years, heart disease, deaths from heart disease in this country are down by 75%. Deaths from stroke in the United States are also down by 75%. So let's think about that. That's 40 years. So we're talking about since the mid-1980s, we have been able to drop the rate of death from heart attack and stroke by 75%. And when we think about that, what are those innovations, right? People are getting stents all the time, diagnostics, clot-busting drugs. We never had these in the 1980s. Now they're common. Someone goes to the hospital, they get there with a stroke, you're able to break up the stroke, and in many cases, these people go back to work. The work they've done in the field of HIV and AIDS, right? It was a death sentence previously. Now we have treatments, and people, again, are able to live normal lives. And I don't have to tell you about all the work that was done during COVID. Ironically, you know, during COVID, we've come up with a medication, right? If you remember, we were looking so desperately for a medication, a monoclonal antibody that would help stop the spread of COVID and treat somebody who has COVID. So ironically, with the budget cuts, 1,300 people have been fired already this year and $2 billion already cut from the budget. But the irony is, among those people who got fired was the doctor who put together the monoclonal antibody in research to give it to who was then President Trump. Right? Do you remember where they had to bring him to NIH, to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and when he was sick? Well, it was that doctor who okayed the use of what was then really on the cutting edge of being released so that he could get it and recover. Now he's looking for a job. And again, this is part of that whole Doge thing, and it's just become awful. And one of the parts of it that's really become a problem is, and you'll see if you get to look at this news segment, many of the people who have been doing this research, who now have lost their funding, lost their jobs, are just going to other countries. So Europe, Canada, Australia, Asia, they've already started recruiting folks. You know, these people have to earn a living. And these are brilliant scientists who we have trained. So in a recent poll, 75% of basic scientists in the United States today are considering leaving the United States. So we have already started a brain drain from this country. And when I think about the medications we've gotten from our research, statins, right? So many people take a statin to keep your cholesterol down, antidepressants, new forms of insulin to help diabetics. All of this comes from NIH funding. Even anti-inflammatory drugs like Celebrex or Meloxicam, all of things were developed by the rheumatology folks at NIH over the years. So we can go on and talk about how our lives have been extended. But the thing that's going on now, the premier things, are Alzheimer's and cancer trials. And those are being shut down. You don't just stop it, give it a break, and then we'll start it up again in a year. Once you shut down these trials that have been going on for years, especially Alzheimer's disease, you don't restart them. So we are losing ground as we speak in this regard. And I mentioned previously about this brilliant idea that we should have a registry for people with autism. And now they're talking about registries for people with other illness. So if you develop an illness, you'll need to register that with the NIH. Talk about an invasion of your privacy. And the persons they're putting in charge, the person they're putting in charge is this guy, David Gear. He's not even a doctor. And this is a fellow who was participating with his father in research in their house on autism. Get this. So his father, who was a doctor and subsequently lost his license, they were doing their own garage research on children. I can't think of another term for it, okay? They were injecting children with Lupron. Lupron is a drug you use for prostate cancer to lower testosterone levels and hopefully the spread of prostate cancer. So you lower testosterone levels with Lupron. They came up with this theory that it was because of the children who were developing, who had autism, if you could lower their testosterone levels, you would essentially cure their autism. No scientific basis for it. What it did lead to is children not being able to grow, not being able to develop bones, not being able to develop muscles. Imagine not having testosterone. So with that, Mr. Gear was fined and found guilty of practicing medicine without a license. And as a reward for that, instead of a prison sentence, he becomes the federal czar now in charge of all of research in autism. $300 million budget. With that, we're going to take a short break. And then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Tanya Bilchik. We're going to be talking about headache today. If you have questions for me, you can get them to Dr. Bilchik by going to info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome my guest today, Dr. Tanya Bilchik. Dr. Bilchik is a board-certified neurologist. She is a specialist in the field of headache and has been delivering care to our state for many years in her original practice in Hartford and now at Yale University. Tanya, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tanya, there's just so much to cover in the field of headache because it's really among the more exciting fields in neurology with everything that's been developed. But to take a step back, can you go over kind of a definition and classification of headache? Because even for those of us in the business, it changes. The classification changes as we start to find new things about headache and headache behaviors.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what you have to realize is that there are primary headache disorders and secondary headache disorders. And the primary headache disorders are the ones we commonly see. And the International Headache Society has actually got a whole classification about headache disorders, and they do split into primary. In other words, there's no cause specific. It's not caused by something else. It's a typical headache disorder. And the most common primary headache disorder that we see is migraine. And tension headache is another very common headache disorder. And then secondary headache disorders are the ones we worry about. It's caused by something else. So I think that kind of when I'm talking to patients, they're more worried about something being ominous. So they're more worried about the secondary headache disorders. But 99% of the time, it's a primary headache disorder. So we talk about what's reassuring. International Headache Society classification of migraine is a moderately severe headache with associated symptoms of light sensitivity and noise sensitivity and or nausea. And people don't realize that not all migraines are associated with a visual abnormality or a visual aura. Only about 20% to 25% of people with migraine have visual changes with their migraines. And so it's not a kind of uncommon thing when somebody sees me and says, well, I don't really have migraines. I got these bad headaches with nausea and light sensitivity. But I know they're not migraines because of the visual changes. So we know that there are migraines with and without aura. I think that's the most common thing that somebody is coming to see their doctor for. On the other hand, the most common headache that everybody gets is a tension headache. And that is, you know, a very common headache that is moderate or mild to moderate. And it's more of a band-like headache, a tight squeezing feeling. And there isn't nausea or light sensitivity. You can have a little light sensitivity or a little noise sensitivity, but not both. So those are our common kinds of most frequently seen headache disorders.
Tanya, I guess here's a quick question. Do you think the diagnosis of migraine is overused or underused? When people come to their doctor and say, oh, I have migraine headaches, do you think that it's an overdiagnosis or underdiagnosis?
I think it's getting better. When I started doing headache as a primary specialty in the late 1990s, there was a kind of a graph that it was almost like the tip of the iceberg type scenario where only about 40% of people that really had migraine were given the diagnosis. And as the years have changed and people are more aware, I think that it's now becoming more appropriate that people are now much more aware that they've had migraines. So I still think, even though it's 2025, I think migraine is still a little bit underdiagnosed because people think it's a sinus headache because, yep, hey, it's in my face, or it's not a migraine because I don't have visual symptoms. So I think it's still a little bit underdiagnosed.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Tanya Bilczek. We're talking about headaches, and I already have a question coming in here about headaches in children that we'll get to right after the break. So if you have any questions, you can get them to me, and we'll ask Dr. Bilczek about headache. You get those over to me at info@alessimd.com. We're going to be back after a short break. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have my guest with me today, Dr. Tanya Bilczek. We're talking about headache, and if you have questions, you can get them over to me at info@alessimd.com. Tanya, Alicia had a question, and that was, how young can you see headache patients and the appearance of migraine headaches? How young does a child typically have to be before you make that diagnosis?
That's actually an interesting question because I'm an adult neurologist specializing in headache. However, I have seen adolescents, and when you really start taking a detailed history from patients, they will say, I remember when I was 3 or 4 years old, my mother told me I would be holding my head and crying. And in fact, I think that migraines do occur in children. Sometimes they cannot tell you that they're experiencing head pain, but they're just crying when they're really little. And as they get older, obviously, migraines can show up in kids at 5, 6 years old when they can start verbalizing. And a lot of times kids' migraines are actually short, much shorter than adult migraines, but they're associated with nausea and vomiting. Kids will often just go to sleep, and within an hour or two, they're back to normal and not, as if nothing has happened. But yes, kids get migraines too. Often there's a family history, and in that case, the parents are more aware. But babies, young children, toddlers, elementary school kids absolutely get headache. And there's another form or variety of a migraine disorder that is more common in children than in adults, and that is called abdominal migraine. They may just present with abdominal pain that's unexplained. And there were a couple of retrospective studies looking at unexplained abdominal pain in children. And as adolescents, that symptom really became a precursor to a typical migraine. So the answer is yes. Kids get migraines. Kids should be treated for migraine. And often you will find that if you treat for migraine in children, their headaches go away. Simple analgesics, usually ibuprofen, that kind of thing is usually effective. But if that doesn't work, then obviously one has to look for either a different cause or a different medication. And most pediatricians are very aware that migraines occur in kids.
Tanya, you know, we talked a little bit about people have become more aware of the diagnosis of migraine. Do you think some of that has to be due to the ads on TV for migraine medication and things like that now that they've become so common?
I think so. And there's also Dr. Google, who has become a very widespread. I think people look up their symptoms a lot more. I mean, sometimes positively, sometimes to the detriment. But I think the public awareness, I mean, I remember that direct-to-consumer advertising did not exist many years ago.
Sure.
And it was up to primary care doctors to make a diagnosis. But now there seems to be a lot more awareness, both with media and with people looking up their own symptoms, and I agree, advertising.
You know, one of the, topics.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No. I carry on.
Well, one of the topics we wanted to talk about was a little bit about facial pain and headache pain. But John just got in touch with me with a question here. And what could be done to relieve headaches caused by bruxism? So maybe kind of incorporate that with facial pain.
Okay, well, you know, bruxism, grinding teeth, clenching teeth is actually pretty common. And it's one of the things that we call a comorbidity. It goes along with migraine, but it also goes along with, you know, tight neck muscles, tension, all of that kind of thing. So, you know, most of the time people present with quote-unquote TMJ. My jaw hurts, I've got jaw pain, I've got pain when I chew, I grind my teeth. Your dentist will say, oh, you've been grinding your teeth, you're wearing them down. They are on-label and off-label. The dentist will make devices. They will use mouth guards. There's a device called an NTI device. Oral surgeons, and I even do Botox into the masseter muscles to decrease the kind of clenching, tightening. Botox into the temporalis muscle, which is the muscle, if you kind of clench down, you can feel it in your temple. So we can do Botox into the temporalis and into the masseter muscle to help to relax. Obviously, stress management is really important. And physical therapy is sometimes helpful. So I think getting a diagnosis is important. Sometimes muscle relaxants are helpful. Getting a mouth guard, an NTI device, or, you know, Botox is helpful too. Botox is off-label, though. So it's not FDA approved for clenching teeth or bruxism. However, it has been shown to be effective, and it's been being used for, you know, 20-something years for that condition.
You know, I'd not heard of that, and yet it makes a lot of sense to be able to use Botox for the masseter muscle and clenching teeth. But, you know, since we've touched on the idea of devices used to treat headache, and probably doing this a little backwards before we get to medications, but Let's talk about some of the devices that are out there, right? So we see people, they sell these cooling hats, electrical stimulators, things like that. Can you talk a little bit about the devices that are out there? I mean, they're as simple as a mouth guard to the more sophisticated right. ones.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the first thing, if you go onto Amazon or one of the websites, is a quote-unquote migraine hat.
Right.
I first found out about it when my patients started wearing it into my office when they had an acute headache, and the theory is that ice will take pain away. You know, as simple as an ice pack or a bag of frozen peas. But in the last 20 years, it's gotten a lot more sophisticated. The first device that came out was something called a Cephaly. C-E-P-H-A-L-Y, and it looked like a kind of a Star Trek kind of gizmo that was almost worn like a headband over the forehead. I don't know if you remember that.
It's just
a tens unit. Yeah, it's a tens unit. So it's now become a much smaller device, and it sticks to the forehead with a kind of Velcro and electrodes, and it shoots little electric impulses into the nerve. We talk about facial pain and nerves. The whole innervation or nerve supply of the face is a nerve called the trigeminal nerve. So the theory is if you can stimulate the supraorbital nerve, which is a branch of the trigeminal, it will kind of send a feedback and prevent and treat an acute migraine. So that's one of the older devices. But in the last 10 years, there are a whole lot of new ones. There's something called a magnetic TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. This is using magnets and a kind of a device that you hold on the back of your head, and it sends little magnetic impulses to the back of the head to the neurons, and again is something that can treat an acute migraine or prevent a migraine. So there's that device. Then there's another newer device called the Nerivio device, and it's again, using electric impulses. It's an armband. You put it on your arm. You control the kind of the impulse with your cell phone, and you stimulate one of the peripheral nerves, in other words, a nerve in your arm, to send a signal to your brain to then shut down some of the pain signaling coming from the trigeminal nerve or the migraine. And there's another device, which is a newer one that is kind of like the old Cephaly device or whatever that was, that not only attaches to the front of your head, but also attaches to the back of your head, like a headband thing. And it's got electrodes on the face and electrodes at the back of the head, and again, sending electrical impulses to try and decrease pain. Unfortunately, these devices have been FDA cleared. In other words, they are available, but they're not approved. They're not FDA, they're FDA cleared, but they're not FDA approved. There's kind of a subtle difference. They're available, but a lot of the times the insurances don't cover them, and the efficacy is variable. But for people who don't want to take medications or cannot take medications, you know, pregnant ladies, things like that, these are an alternative. I think we don't use them that much because it's not covered a lot of times by insurance, but some people like them. You know, it's from your simple bag of ice to some fancy electric gizmo that you control with your cell phone. So interesting devices.
As I recall, the Cephaly device, you used it like once or twice a day. These aren't things that you would wear all the time, like the cooling.
No.
Hat, correct?
No, no. You basically, the Cephaly you leave on for about 30 to 40 minutes for right. an acute migraine. So some of these are, you leave the Nerivio device, you leave on for like 40 minutes. They've all got different timings. They're interesting. I don't think that they will replace what we have, but I like to kind of, if somebody is really interested in alternatives, if we're talking about alternatives, things like acupuncture, massage therapy, all of the other alternatives are also helpful for people. And I think the most important alternative that's not really an alternative is something called mindfulness. You know, cognitive behavioral therapy, relaxation therapy, using your own kind of brain to settle down your migraine and reduce some of the pain intensity, almost like meditation in a way.
Tanya, I'm going to ask you a question I've never asked you before. What do you think about chiropractic? We always see patients coming in now, oh, well, I get adjusted, and that takes care of it, so I go a couple of times a week.
I think you have to be careful because, you know, as neurologists, you know that there are so many very vital structures in your neck. A good chiropractor won't do kind of mega manipulations into the neck because they know that if they interrupt some of the blood vessels and the nerves, you can have damage. And, you know, we, as neurologists, particularly when we're all used to do general neurology, we see somebody coming in after a chiropractic manipulation with an arterial dissection, which would then lead to stroke. So that's rare. The chiropractors are very aware of it, but I think you have to be careful. I think massage and chiropractic without these kind of rapid manipulations would be really helpful in decreasing some of the tight neck muscles. But I'm kind of, you know, you've got to be careful. As we've all seen people that have had strokes after chiropractic
Absolutely.
Manipulation of the neck.
Yes.
But some, as long as they're not doing that kind of vigorous jerking neck movement, anything's helpful. Again, because, you know, a lot of times the migraines or headaches are also associated with a lot of neck muscle tightness. Because we're all sitting at computers all the time.
Yeah, and you know, I think I've found younger chiropractors have so many other things available that I rarely see them doing high velocity manipulations of the neck for things like
Absolutely.
That, especially in acute care. But I think previously that was the only thing they would do.
Just like everything in headache has evolved, everything in all of the fields have evolved to be safer. I mean, think of the drugs we used to use for migraine in the day. Remember things like butalbital and Furoset and all of those things that we used to use, and now it's like, we're not using those. They're addictive. They're barbiturates. We don't do that.
Okay, I got some questions. So we're going to get into treatment, but has there been a resurgence of Furoset? I mean, I don't know why, but I'm seeing more people who went to the emergency room and they got Furoset, butalbital. Have you seen more of it? I have.
Not here, fortunately. I mean, Furoset was a really good drug in the 90s when you had nothing else.
Yeah.
But it's a barbiturate. I think that, unfortunately, Furoset has also been seriously maligned. It's not available. It's addictive. People like it. I mean, it works nicely, and I won't say I never prescribe it, but I haven't really, down in kind of southern Connecticut, I haven't really seen a resurgence of use. It used to be used a lot in primary care, but even primary care has gone away from it. Occasionally, I'll get a phone call from one of my colleagues saying, how do I get this patient off Furoset? She's on 10 a day. But we used to see that. We don't see it anymore.
You know, and,
I don't know about, you know, your area.
Yeah, but, you know, and we've seen, you know, we've seen the ergots and other treatments. But really, from the early 90s, since the advent of triptans, that has really just changed the treatment of migraine headaches. Can you talk a little bit about the evolution from triptans and now CGRP antagonists?
Absolutely. You know, having been around since, you know, practice in Hartford in 1994, I've seen the whole gamut. I mean, when we first started out, Imitrex injections were brand new, and we used to bring patients into the emergency room. Triptans are now our standard of care. Unfortunately, because they have the potential to cause narrowing of blood vessels, people with history of stroke or heart disease or multiple vascular risk factors, we're a little bit nervous about using them. Plus, triptans also have a few more side effects than our newer, we'll just talk more about acute, but our newer acute medications. So the theory on migraine is that when you're developing migraine symptoms, migraine prodrome, you're getting the release of a neuropeptide or a neurotransmitter called CGRP, calcitonin gene-related peptide. It's not related to calcium, by the way. And so CGRP is released. So the theory is if you can block CGRP from getting to its receptor, you can treat or prevent a migraine. And in the last 8 years, there have been a couple of acute medications that you take at the onset of migraine. There's ubrogepant, which is Ubrelvy, that's its trade name, and rimegepant. Its trade name is Nurtec, and these drugs have been very successful in blocking the CGRP receptors, so treating an acute migraine that way. And they can be used in people that have more of a vascular risk profile, or people that have had significant side effects from triptans, or the triptans don't work. So I think it's really changed. They're not better than the triptans. They're just a little bit better tolerated than the triptans, and they work pretty well. The downside is obviously because they're brand name medication, they're more expensive than the older drugs, and insurances want us to try some of the older drugs first, and if they work, great, and if they don't, then we can often get prior authorizations for these newer medications that are effective with a lower side effect profile. So hopefully the cost will come down at some stage.
When you're using a triptan, do you often use it in combination with an NSAID? So like these various combinations, I was just reading about somebody saying using meloxicam with Maxalt. Do you often use a combination like that?
I do. I mean, we used to do this. We used to do this in the 90s. We'd say, okay, take sumatriptan or Imitrex with naproxen, which is prescription Aleve. And then this pill came out called Trexmet, which was a combination of sumatriptan and naproxen, and it worked better than the sumatriptan alone and better than the naproxen alone. And then, again, because it was a brand-name medication, it got expensive. And so we've told our patients, take a triptan with an anti-inflammatory. They work on different mechanisms. And I think the FDA just approved, or is just approving, as you said, this combination of rizatriptan, which is the generic for Maxalt, and meloxicam, which is the generic for Mobic. And it's come out as a combination medication for acute migraines. So another kind of newer combination, with the theory that the meloxicam may be a little better tolerated than the naproxen. But time will tell as to the cost, because I think in these days we're so cost careful that we have to see how that goes.
How about injectables? We talked a little bit about botulinum toxin, but what about like occipital blocks, trigger point injections? Are you still doing those?
Oh, yeah, we do. You know, I think that we use them a lot for acute migraine, and that is using novocaine, lidocaine, bupivacaine, and the same nerves that are responsible for migraine, the branches of the trigeminal, we inject right up into, sounds kind of scary, but it really isn't. We put lidocaine just above the eyebrows into the supraorbital region, and you knock out that nerve. It's almost like turning off a light switch that's flickering, and that will block some of the migraine. And then the occipital nerve is the nerve at the back of your head, and we inject that with the thought that it also helps with a feedback to blocking acute migraine. I use them mostly for acute migraine. Somebody's had 3 or 4 days of headache and it's just not going away, or a really bad headache, or a pregnant lady who can't take a bunch of medication, and we know that the numbing medicines are all relatively safe. So we can use lidocaine to help with a pregnant lady with acute migraine. But also, in some people, we can use it preventively. Again, I think of it as preventive in people that are pregnant, you know, every 4 to 6 weeks. We can use it preventively, acutely. It's not a difficult procedure. It's just, it sounds pretty scary when somebody is coming right at your eye or above your eye with a tiny little needle. But as long as you get used to that, it works pretty effectively. I like it for acute, better than preventive, but I've used it for preventive as well. And then if we're talking about injectables, we've also got the injectable monthly injections for migraine prevention as well. And those have really changed lives. The CGRP injectable monoclonal antibodies that you inject once a month. And they're excellent preventers. And I didn't invent them. I did some of the trials. But my favorite saying is somebody comes in and they go, this has changed my life.
Yep.
Kind of like the Ozempic for migraine.
Oh, yeah. Here's a question from Robert. When should you have an MRI for headache? And I think that's always a good question, because patients always, you know, they come in and expect an imaging study right away. So when does imaging fit into your workup?
Okay, so we talk about red flags and headache, and I think that's really important. In other words, these are the things that make us worry that this is not a primary headache, this is a secondary headache. New onset headache after the age of 50, you've never had headaches before, you've never had migraine. So new onset headache, headache with fever, again, that's another concerning symptom. Maybe it's an infection, maybe it's a meningitis. Headache with focal neurological symptoms, in other words, new onset headache or even previous headache with weakness, numbness, something different. Headache with focal neurologic symptoms, headache that's a total change in headache pattern. This is a brand new, I've never had this before. Unfortunately, a lot of times people cry wolf and it's like, well, I think this MRI is going to help me. And it's really just more likely to help peace of mind. But yeah, if somebody comes in and they've never had an imaging study, even if they kind of sound just like a migraine and they've never had an imaging study and it's most likely a migraine, I think it's not a terrible thing to do some kind of imaging. So also a change in headache pattern. Somebody who always gets migraine and it's always similar, suddenly there's something totally different. I think that's another reason. But we also look at our green flags. What are things that are reassuring that I don't need an imaging study? The headaches are always the same. They're episodic. I don't have any headache symptoms in between headache attacks. They're all, you know, my mom had headaches. There's a genetic predisposition. Green flags. So, you know, those are the other things. I always get headaches with my menstrual cycle. Another thing that's kind of like a green flag. So I used to kind of be pretty tough about, yeah, we don't need imaging study, but I've also been caught. So I think that if a patient comes to me and says, I'm really worried, you know, my aunt had a brain tumor, my mother had an aneurysm, I have a low threshold because MRIs are non-invasive. I tend to rather get an MRI than a CAT scan. I think it gives us more imaging information. And, you know, I've become less tough than I used to be. I think that if you're worried, peace of mind is not a terrible thing. That's not what we are taught in medical school.
No, it's not. It's not. That's why I love having you. That's why I love having you on the air. Tanya, thank you so much for your time. This has been great.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for all the information. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. Many thanks to our studio producer, Kevin Kors, has been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Many of the things we talked about today about NIH and research, these are things that affect your life. They are going to affect the lives of everyone listening to this program. No matter what your politics are, whether you're in a red state, blue state, or how you feel, the things we talk about on this program affect your life and affect your health. And you could sit back and just let them do whatever they want, or you can choose to get out and protest. Protest by sending a letter, contacting your elected officials, sending an email, or getting out there in March. And I could tell you right now, I choose to be vocal and to get in their face, because I can tell you right now, this will affect the longevity of everyone listening to this program. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.